Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
I mean, no one plans to get sick. And yet, here we are. My name is Matthew Zachary. A quarter century ago, I was given 6 months to live with a diagnosis of terminal brain cancer. For more than 15 years, I've been ranting and raving on the air about stupid cancer and now stupid healthcare, and I'm just getting warmed up. So let's all go make healthcare suck less together, because you know what? We're all out of patience. Hey, that's the name of the show. Hello, friends. Welcome back. Got a good show for you today. Dr. Teresa Brown, RN, a nurse, a PhD, author, New York Times bestselling author of that. She joins me today to talk about her third book, Healing, When a Nurse Becomes a Patient, from Algonquin. Yes, when the cancer nurse becomes the cancer patient. She has a phenomenal sense of humor and an incredible perspective of, again, as an oncology nurse, how the inner workings are what they are. And when the coin flipped on her life, what it was like to be literally a fish out of water while still in the fishbowl. You know, one might think that being a nurse in oncology before you get cancer could be to your advantage, but not the case. Among the many things we talk about, besides telling really bad dad jokes about nurses and medicine, are things like caregiver burden and survivor guilt and scanxiety and the contest that really shouldn't be a contest about stage one, stage four, I'm better than you, I'm worse than you, you only had 3 surgeries, I had 9 surgeries. This very well may be the first show I've ever done that channels Fast Times at Ridgemont High and Ferris Bueller through the lens of nursing and throwing tons of shade at Grey's Anatomy at the same time. Oh, one last thing. We had a couple of sound glitches and tech issues during the show, so please forgive any blips, bleeps, and weird stuff, and all praise our producers for making the magic happen. So without further ado, I present Teresa Brown. Enjoy the show. Teresa Brown, Nurse Brown, welcome to Out of Patience.
Thank you for having me.
My first question, how many Teresas do you know without the H, and are you offended? Or is that a Shonda?
I have met quite a few, and in fact, there was another Teresa Brown in my high school without an H.
Are you kidding me?
I'm not.
I mean, at one point, there were like 4 Matthews in my fourth grade class, but my last name was the only last name of that letter. At least, yeah, you lost that bet.
Yeah. And in fact, I get Google alerts for Teresa Brown, and there's a lot of Teresa Browns.
That's incredible. My first grade crush was Teresa, so it's a special name in my backstory.
Aw. Well, I'll try to be as charming as a crush-worthy first grader.
You're going to channel real hard. She's still around. We're still friends. It's interesting, like 40 billion years ago in first grade. Like, I got a crush. Look at that.
Nice.
I want to start by, what's the darkest inappropriate nursing joke you've ever told?
Oh my gosh. I don't know if I could tell that on your... I mean, we're all supposed to be angels and heroes, right?
Right. How about I give you one of mine? It's not that bad. It's probably a joke my daughter would tell me if I told her to go look up nursing jokes. What did the nurse say to the man who fainted in the airport?
I don't know.
Sir, I'm afraid you have a terminal illness.
Oh, that's terrible. I love it.
All right. I'll tell the inappropriate one because I'm channeling Gilbert Gottfried this week for some reason. Why did the COVID ward have the fastest Wi-Fi?
I don't know.
It had too many hotspots.
Oh, actually, I thought of now a great inappropriate nursing joke.
Oh, please do tell.
Okay. So this is actually one a medical examiner told me. So it's kind of a medical examiner joke too. So he said, it's a crime scene, police there, people in all their, you know, white suits, just like on TV. And the medical examiner goes up, kind of looks at the body and says, okay, well, one thing we know is this was a nurse. And someone else says, well, how can you know that? And he says, well, it's obvious. The stomach is empty, the bladder is full, and the ass is half chewed off.
Oh, my God. God. All hail misogyny. That's a good one right there. I love that. That's fantastic.
I told a non-healthcare person that joke once, and I think it's hilarious. And she was really horrified.
You know, it's like you're the nurse that got cancer. Congratulations. But the humor of it all is kind of what keeps us together. And when I started my nonprofit a million years ago, which was probably 10 years out of when I had cancer, we leaned into the darkest comedy ever. We had a T-shirt that said, ovaries are for losers, or who needs nipples anyway, or, you know, bald is beautiful. We had one that said something like, just like Animal Planet, but with better genetics or something like that. More hair, different mm-hmm. hair. It was the humor. Move ahead to go back. Did you find the humor in this, or was it tragedy the whole time and what the fuckery the whole time? Or like, where did it get to you? Like, this is so inane. I have to be comical.
I mean, sometimes I found the humor. At a very dark moment, I was looking up pictures of women who'd had mastectomies, which I do not recommend to anyone. And I did not need a mastectomy. But I might have if my genetic results had been different. They were great. But anyway, one of the pictures I saw was a woman wearing a shirt that said, of course these are fake. My real ones tried to kill me.
I remember that shirt. Yeah.
But mostly I found the situation macabre, and since we're already going all inappropriate here, yeah, it was more like what the fuckery, as you said.
Yeah. So we're going to talk about your book in the second half of the show. I want the listeners to get to know who you are. You already said fuck twice, so you're in the club. Boom. The book is Healing When a Nurse Becomes a Patient, from Algonquin Books. I was reading, you had something in an article you wrote somewhere, like somehow one might think that being a nurse and getting cancer is to your advantage, but at the same time, that shouldn't be a requisite.
Yes. And even I, someone who knows how to work the system, I got overwhelmed by what I call DIY cancer cares and do it yourself. Mm-hmm. There was no guideline, nothing. No one looking out for me. No one saying, hey, have you made this appointment? Hey, we can help you. Nothing like that. So supposedly I knew how it worked, but I couldn't make it work for me as the nurse. And believe me, I tried. I made those phone calls. I used the same voice I use in the hospital that produces results. Sometimes it made a difference, and sometimes it made no difference at all.
You're preaching to the choir. Not that I was a nurse or a doctor before I got cancer. I was in college. But I've been working in health policy, and I've been fucked by healthcare through prescription benefits and all sorts of payer coverage nonsense. And I work the system, and you're still fucked by the system.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's nothing you can do about it. I also read this whole idea of, like, I knew breast cancer as a nurse, but it sounded like you felt guilty that you didn't know enough because you didn't have it yet. And I don't know if that's a burden that should have been there for you, but yes, you're a nurse. You're here to help. It's your job. And then when mm-hmm. you become on the other side of that job, are you unfit to be a nurse because you didn't know what it was like?
Well, it wasn't so much guilt. There was some guilt, but it was more the feeling, the understanding that I was mortally afraid. And so people should know I had a stage one, very slow growing tumor diagnosed in fall of 2017. And I only say that because if you're going to have breast cancer, this is the kind you want. It's the most common kind. It's very treatable. And I was absolutely terrified. Terrified. I was taking care of patients with leukemia and lymphoma. They had very, very serious, scary systemic disease that would kill them if they didn't get treatment right away. And I did not understand that. So the point is that there were all kinds of glitches that I experienced, right? And sounds like you've experienced. And as a patient, they were horrible. As a nurse, when I'd seen things like that happen, I thought, yeah, that's bad, but you know what? we're curing you, we're treating you, we all care so much about you, we make the difference. And as a patient, I realized, no, you don't. Because having a serious disease is so intense and so overwhelming. And it was that contrast that got me to write the book, because I think all of us in healthcare need to work harder at understanding that patients are people. They're not on an assembly line. They have strong feelings. They need support. And because everyone is now so focused on what they call throughput and revenue,
yeah,
there's not time for that the way there should be.
I'm going to jump back for a sec, because I was hearing, and again, I've been in cancer advocacy for 18 years at this point, and I worked in young adult cancer, so breast cancer in young women was a vastly different experience than breast cancer in your 40s and 50s or whatnot, because, again, just not better or worse, a different time of life, but this idea of the contest, I'm worse off than you, and this idea that somehow if I was diagnosed with something worse than you, you could never relate to me. And if I was diagnosed with something less worse than you, I look up to you because I feel that you're in a worse place than me. I was really pissed off about that. We want people to be diagnosed at earlier stages. And if not for the fortune of luck, it's for the sake of progress and recognizing how far we've come, that this can be a thing now that wasn't a thing. And I'm happy when I meet people that were diagnosed like me at stage four. Like, good for you. You know,
right. Hopefully
I wanted to suck less for you. Thank you for, you know, did you get a sense of that? The breast cancer forums can be horrible and vicious and territorial. Were you exposed to that?
I made a decision early on to spend as little time online as I could, except for when I could not stop looking at mastectomy pictures. but I think a sense of that is why I avoided that. And once my husband and I were in a waiting room for some, maybe it was my MRI, I can't remember even, and two people were having that conversation. I told him, I said, I have to go out in the hallway. I can't stand this. So, yeah, I mean, I remember talking once about how hard it was for me on tamoxifen, and someone said, well, I went into surgical menopause. Think what that was like. Just like, I don't want to think what that was like, you know, like, yeah, it was probably worse than what I went through. Or maybe it wasn't. Like, what's the point?
Right.
It's not a contest. We all deserve empathy for what we're going through.
Yeah.
You know, you don't get it. Hey, I suffered the most. Okay, gold star, you win.
So gold star for you, stage four person. Like, it, why? I understand the transference. It's highly emotional. Your life is like, we've all been there, right? We've all in some way, shape or form, maybe not all of us, have faced a degree of mortality. And isn't that enough to level set you just being in a club where we all are supporting each other?
Right. I mean, it's like in the book at one point, I say, there's no good cancer diagnosis. There's bad and there's worse. There's terrible and there's tragic. And it's not a competition. And like you say, you know, there might be a 20-year-old who got the same diagnosis I got, and it feels like the end of their life because they're young. They haven't had their kids yet. They're supposed to be invulnerable because they're in their 20s. You know, I mean, it just depending on who someone is and where they are in their life, it could be so much worse than what someone else feels. And why compare? There's no point to it.
No, there's no point. I have several friends. I mentioned the San Antonio squad of young adult survivors who are oncologists. And their story is like, I had to doctor my doctor. And at some point, how do you just let your doctor be your doctor without playing the role of a doctor? And you're a nurse with a doctor now. Did you have to unplug your nurse personality, your nursenality? Have you do unplug your nursenality through your treatments?
No, actually, the problem for me was that once I was diagnosed, I felt so disconnected from the nurse part of myself. I forgot what I had learned about breast cancer. I just lost that part of myself. So that there's a whole section in the book called Nurse Brown, MIA, because I didn't know where that part of me was. But then the problem was, here I am, I just want to be the patient, and people kept letting me down right and left. So now with my oncologist, I am more of the nurse, and I'm Teresa Brown, the writer, and I know what's going on, and let's not bullshit with each other. And to his credit, my medical oncologist can totally work with that, and I am very thankful.
You mentioned the diagnosis of stage one.
Mm-hmm.
It was that like the in situ, or there was a lump, or you had a like, what was your actual diagnosis and treatment?
Yeah, so it was diagnosed on ultrasound. I had a follow-up to my mammogram, and I was part of a study that was looking at whether mammography with ultrasound gets better diagnostic results, which the study found that it didn't, but I felt like, hey, it did for me. So diagnosed on ultrasound, there was no lump, there was nothing I felt, nothing. She actually also saw some calcifications in a different location she was worried about. So that was kind of terrifying. I had to have two different biopsies, and I kept sort of thinking, like, could I have two different cancers in one breast? And which was scary. But the calcifications were just calcifications, which are calcium deposits for people who don't know, but can be suggestive of breast cancer, but certainly are not always. So it was, a tumor very close to my armpit. So it was very hard to find on mammogram, and it was even hard to do the mammograms because then they wanted to image it. Small, so slow growing and tubular, I found out later. And the shape of the tumor cells, I think, has a lot to do with saying how aggressive the tumor is going to be. And a tubular shape is good. Did you see Fast Times from Ridgemont High?
Oh my God, I actually watched that like 3 days ago with my wife.
Yeah, so I'm totally dating myself, but every time anyone says tubular, I just see Sean Penn
it's
as
Sean
Spicoli.
Penn.
Yes.
My favorite line from that movie, so he's on the phone with Judge Ryan Tolani, he hits the shoe on his head, it's like, dude, what's this sound? That's my head! I love that scene.
Yeah, so maybe Fast Times at Ridgemont High could somehow be a sort of metaphor for cancer treatment. Like, you're going through all this stuff just like adolescents. You don't know what the hell's going on, you know?
I mean, you could always go the stripper nurse from Ferris Bueller. And on that note, we'll take a quick break and be right back with Teresa Brown, author of the book Healing When a Nurse Becomes a Patient from Algonquin.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Mm-hmm.
All right, now that we channel Ferris Bueller and Fast Times at Ridgemont High, I have to get to something you brought up in the book, which is pop culture's representation of medicine on television and how they get it wrong and right. And, you know, there's a group called Hollywood Health and Society. They're supposedly like the experts in guiding screenwriters in accuracy in Boston Legal or ER or any of the legal law, whatever, if it's medical or criminal. They're supposed to represent honesty and integrity and something reasonable, even though you need suspension of disbelief. Do you particularly pick on like a Grey's Anatomy, for example? They're the easiest to pick on.
Yes, they are pick-onable, and I do pick on them. In fact, my daughter likes that show, and now she won't let me watch it with her because she says I'm too annoying, which is fair. But the thing that really gets me is the doctors do everything in that hospital. They're always there. You know, a patient's having an emergency. Well, there's a doctor, of course, right out in the hallway. And when the patient's upset, of course, it's the doctor who goes in to talk to them. And in real life, 9 times out of 10, that's going to be the nurse, because doctors don't just hang around in hospital hallways because they're seeing patients in clinic or doing all kinds of other, you know, they're working. They just, part of their job is not sitting in the hallway in the hospital waiting until needed. That's why we have nurses who work 24/7, and they can call a doctor if they need to. So when I get asked about this, what I say and what I've been saying for several years now is, why can't these shows just have nurses doing nurses' work? Just have some nurse characters.
Right. Makes no sense.
And I'd be happy to help them with those scripts if they would like. Just putting it out there.
Dear Hollywood Health and Society, you must hire Teresa Brown now. I know you're listening. Hollywood Health and Society, you're listening to the show.
Because that would make me really happy. Or someone else. But, you know, just do it. Do it right.
You know, you mentioned this at the top of the show, and I know it's also in your book, this idea of like, were you treated the way that you treated patients as a nurse? And this perception or reality of where is empathy in medicine, and is there supposed to be empathy in medicine, and what role can it play? And this notion of, do you deserve dignity and respect, or you just want to be cured, right? Wherein lies the rub between you want a mechanic to take care of you or a therapist to help guide you through it that isn't a mechanic, or somewhere in between?
Yeah, and I wanted both without realizing that 3/4 of the way through the book, I feel sad that I didn't pick clinicians who were more warm and fuzzy. And my dog actually ended up filling that role in my life, who, you know, she is literally warm and fuzzy. But I think people need both. And that's what I found out researching the book, that patients who are treated compassionately actually do better. They have less anxiety. They can report less pain. They need less pain medication. Now, just imagine if I had felt like someone was actually directing my care and making these phone calls for me and making things happen in a timely way, I would have felt so much better about everything that was going on. I wouldn't have had to take people's time calling and getting angry that things weren't happening. I mean, just there's a lot of wasted time and energy because patients are just expected to go along to get along. And a lot of patients will do that and some will not. And part of what I'm encouraging is for more patients not to do that. Ask questions. Make sure you understand. Ask if something can be speeded up. You know, our care needs to be on our schedule, not the schedule of the big money-making healthcare machine, whenever possible.
Right. I've talked about this particular thing on my show a lot, which is I call it the chutzpah factor or the moxie factor for the non-Jewish people out there, which is not everyone's born an advocate. A lot of people are just want to be rightfully terrified and subservient to what they just need to be told to do and don't even think to ask, well, is this right for me or is there another option for me? My quick anecdote about this, and this is on the record for 20 years now, is I was a concert pianist when I got sick and they wanted to give me vincristine, which would give me neuropathy in my fingers. And they didn't tell me that was the side effect. They wanted to give it to me. I was lucky to have an uncle who was a genomicist that said, you don't want this. So then I packed to the doctors. I don't want this. I'm a concert pianist. And they're like, what's wrong with you? You don't want to live? So this idea of just not being treated as a person and not being asked what's best for you is not always on everyone's, you know, tip of the tongue to ask that. Did you find yourself in a situation through this procedure where you weren't being treated as who you were as a person?
Yeah, well, I had initially been told you won't need chemotherapy. Great. And then after my surgery, my surgeon's PA said, well, you might need chemotherapy. And I thought, what? And she seemed completely unprepared for how much that would upset me, and also didn't know who made the decision or what the timeline was for making the decision or what I could do to get that decision made. And that's such a small example, but I always feel like it's like saying, well, we might have to amputate your foot.
Yeah.
I mean, how can you tell someone, well, you might need chemotherapy? Like, that's a huge deal.
Yeah, it's just like something like casual aside at the water cooler. By the way.
Yeah, right.
You're getting chemo.
Right. It's like, hey, John, yeah, we're moving you to the Alaska office.
Teresa, let's focus on your husband and your family when you went through this. This notion of the burden of the caregiver. Nurses are caregivers, but when it's your family that becomes the caregiver, again, at any level of severity, did that give you guilt to put this onus and burden on your husband and your children? Or was there an onus at all?
I don't think I felt guilty. My kids were all in college, so they were older, although it was also the start of my twin daughter's freshman year. I think literally they'd been students for a week or something when I was first diagnosed. And so that's really hard. The kids were very calm. And I asked my surgeon's nurse about that. And she said, well, you're calm, so they're calm. And I thought, well, okay, am I calm? But I think my husband, who came to all my appointments and stepped up when I was feeling lost, I really wish there had been something for him, because it was really hard for him. And he wasn't, I think, good at saying that, because he was trying to take care of me. And, you know, we bumbled our way through. But I wish there had been something for him. And we had a friend with really serious ovarian cancer who actually ended up dying. But he and that friend's husband once got together and talked about, oh, our wives have cancer. But there's just so little for the families. And I mean, I told my kids, you can come to an appointment if you want. You don't have to. You can always ask me more. If you want to hear less, that's fine too. I mean, I tried to give them as much space as possible. The really nice thing, and this didn't make it into the book, but after my lumpectomy, my son actually, he was in college too here in Pittsburgh, but moved back into the house for the weekend and cooked for me. And that was lovely. I mean, they were just so lovely throughout, all three of the kids. And my husband too, but I couldn't really be there for him. And who was going to be there for him?
You also talk about your mom in the book, and I feel like she was like the Iron Lady. Nothing affected her, and she was,
yeah.
And then, you know, she was on suboxone prevention, and then you get breast cancer. Like there's no such thing as irony, like irony.
Right.
Can you talk about your mom a little bit?
Yeah, well, my mom was diagnosed with hairy cell leukemia when I had just started graduate school in English. That's my past life when I got a PhD in English. And for people who don't know, that is not like an acute leukemia. It's a much rarer disease, and people usually die with it, not of it. And there's a great treatment for it. So she got that treatment after having the disease for about 10 years. It's completely in remission. But at some level, that's what led me to work with leukemia and lymphoma patients, although I didn't figure that out until about 3 years in. That I wanted to give back to the system. But yeah, also, I mean, my mom is just doesn't understand being a patient, because she's never sick except for this leukemia, which also never really made her sick. And then she got this treatment and was cured. So her sense of ill health is not like most people's.
I had an aunt, my father's, actually my paternal grandma's sister, died at 88 of everything at once. And she was just like in this homeostasis of having everything that kept her alive, like invulnerable. She was like made of Purell, but had everything inside her. And she died peacefully in her sleep, like the way you're supposed to. But this idea of like you're invulnerable and yet vulnerable at the same time, I love just the idea of dying normal.
But that also that I had that found that idea so hard when I realized I'm going to have to take a break from home hospice work now that I've been diagnosed with cancer. And that was so hard for me. I knew I had to do it. I knew I would not be able to take care of people who were dying well when I was really worried about dying. But I felt like, but I'm supposed to be invulnerable. I'm a nurse. I'm right. In healthcare. We take care of the sick. We are not the sick ourselves. Something's wrong here. And yet, that's the way it was.
Yep. We could do a whole other show on this particular topic, but I just love your cursory thoughts on this. Because again, it permeates society. The nursing shortage and nursing burnout.
Yeah, and that is a very serious problem right now, especially post-COVID. And as you know, toward the end of the book, I went back to my home hospice job, which was for a for-profit company, which I said I would never do. But I thought because of the medical director, it would be okay. And actually, the company, when I first worked for them, was a good company to work for. And then they got bought by a holding company. And I think for the holding company, it was just a way to make money. And just the work itself became all about nickel and diming us, nickel and diming the patients. And that really just ate away at my sense of commitment to nursing and feeling of I can do this job, because since being a patient, I saw how painful all those small glitches are that we think are small when we're the clinicians, but are not small at all when we're the patients. And I think that's what happened with a lot of nurses. They just could not take it anymore, whether it was seeing all the deaths, whether it was never having enough people on staff. So you know patients are crashing and possibly even dying just because you're not going to be able to get into their room in time.
Right.
Yeah. People will break after a while, you know, or they'll say, this job is breaking me, and so I have to get out of this job. And that's what happened.
So let's wrap with one quick thing. I was also reading, you know, that we use the term scanxiety. Like the last day of treatment, no matter what it is the worst day of treatment, because like you have no idea, there's no handrail left. You're like, what next and what now?
Like that.
Yeah. So scanxiety was coined, I don't know, probably in the 90s at some point. We adopted it at Stupid Cancer. And it's just a great word to use at this point. You know, How are you managing any congenital or induced hypochondria?
You know, I'm doing okay. I am coming up on 5 years, the magic number, even though I know it's arbitrary, because if people don't know this, most research stops looking at people after 5 years. So After 5 years, you're declared clear, even though I don't really know if that's based in science. I mean, your disease can come back or you could get another disease. You know, there's no guarantees. But yeah, for the most part, I'm okay. And writing this book was hard, very hard. But the process of it becoming a book and coming into the world, that was very healing for me. And then when I hear now from people who've read it, I find that very healing, because they say, wow, this is what I went through as a patient. It's so dehumanizing. I'm so glad you wrote this. And then I feel like, wow, not only did I suffer through something, but I was able to turn it into something that it seems like is helping other people. And that feels wonderful. Like that feels like a gift I gave myself, really.
No, it's a fascinating way to, again, like I'm not a cat poster person, and this whole lemon from lemonade thing is a bunch of shit.
Yeah. You know?
But so to close us out, I had one more. You dedicate the book to Sharon. Who's Sharon?
Sharon is my father's sister and my aunt. So she died a few years ago. She was just always a very important person to me. We lived in Southwest Missouri. They lived in St. Louis, so diagonally across the state. My brother and I were good friends with their daughters, our cousins, who were sort of all roughly in the same age group. But she just was one of these people who's always generous, always kind. I remember once being at her house and got up later than everyone else. And she said, well, do you want me to make you some scrambled eggs? And I said, well, you don't have to do that. And she said, well, it's the easiest thing in the world. You know, just that's the kind of person she was.
That's great.
And so losing her just felt like a personal loss, but I just wanted to honor the person she was, the person she aspired to be, because she was just a model for me of kindness and graciousness.
We're going to go out with one more dad joke, nursing joke. How's that? Why are nurses afraid of the outdoors?
I don't know.
Too much poison ivy. I was waiting for it. I was totally waiting for it.
That's terrible. You know what, though? I love bad puns. Yes. I do. So that's great.
Yes. Awesome. Well, Dr. Theresa Brown, RN, nurse, writer, New York Times bestselling author, the new book, Healing When a Nurse Becomes a Patient from Algonquin. Website, TheresaBrownRN.com, on Twitter, at Theresa Brown, Theresa with a TH, like my first grade girlfriend. Thank you so much for coming on my show.
You're welcome. It was a blast.
That's all for now. If you like the show, be sure to subscribe, leave a review on Apple Podcasts, follow us on social, and tell all your friends to listen. Tell us what you'd like Matthew to cover in his next episode by leaving a message for us at 855-AUDIO-66, and we might just use it in a future show. Out of Patients is a product of Offscript Health. We are a healthcare engagement company built for patients and caregivers by patients and caregivers. Our executive producers are Matthew Zachary and Andrew McDowell. Our senior producer is Betsy Shepherd. Our host is Matthew Zachary. It is recorded, mixed, and edited by Betsy Shepherd. For advertising and media inquiries, email media@offscript.com. That's media@offscript.com. For more information, visit offscript.com.